Welcome to Week Question and Learn. Today, a very, very special guest from the Nonprofit Partnership, the executive director of that organization, Adam Bratton. Adam, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And as usual, folks, since COVID-19 has invaded, so to speak, our community, we do our programs via phone and remotely. And so sounds like it's on the phone. It is. Adam, thank you for calling in this morning. How long have you been the executive director now of the Nonprofit Partnership?
About 4.5 years now.
Wow.
So, started mid 2016.
You actually moved in that period of time to, I'm thinking it was during your term, to a new facility, right?
Right. Yeah. So we were when I started, we were up at the WQLM in their facility, had been there for a couple of years.
Yes.
But the Community Foundation had renovated their the carriage house behind their building with the generous support of Mr. Tom Hagen. And we were given the opportunity to come back on the foundation's campus, have a great facility here, meets all of our needs. And we did that at the end of 2016. So we've been here for about 4 years.
You are in the building that used to be the Erie Philharmonic's office?
Yeah, it was it had been offices for a number of years. I think it at some point had housed some county offices and was not in great shape, nothing really original. So there wasn't much rehabilitation to the facility. It was pretty much completely gutted and transformed into what it is now. And again, it has training rooms, offices, conference room, and all those things have been invaluable to us as we kind of expand our reach in the nonprofit sector here.
Well, for folks that are listening from out of town, let's explain what the Nonprofit Partnership is. Let's, if we could, do a little bit of history. It's been around for what?
So the partnership, or at least our mission, was established in about 2001 as a program of the Erie Community Foundation. And about 2006-07 became its own standalone nonprofit. Mm-hmm. Organization. And since then, we've been growing our programs and services. We are very much focused on education, training, professional development of the staff, volunteers, and others within the sector. So we know that the nonprofit sector is made up of people. We don't do our work with large facilities, large pieces of equipment, not a lot of capital investment, but the investment is in the people. So we focus on the people within the sector, trying to give them the skills, abilities, resources in order to have a greater impact on our community.
Well, let's help people understand the breadth and scope of the organization. You are actually a 501c3, correct?
Correct.
Independent,
yep.
Right? And your organization consists of members. Who are your members?
Our members, the only qualification for membership is that you are a nonprofit organization. So 501c3 is the most common nonprofit designation by the IRS. Mm-hmm. There are other designations. I believe there's 29 different designations, but the majority of nonprofits are 501c3. There are 501c4s and c6s, which are, fraternal organizations or chambers of commerce, that sort of thing. But the only caveat for membership is that you're a nonprofit, and we serve as of right now, we have about 400 nonprofits. Primarily in northwestern Pennsylvania. And our nonprofits are totally and completely diverse. So we have new startup, all volunteer nonprofits to the largest organizations and businesses in our region, universities, health systems, that sort of thing. So it really runs the gamut. Like the rest of the country, a majority of our nonprofits are smaller. So most nonprofits in the U.S. are smaller nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And so we certainly try to find out, discover what they need, meet them where they are. Of course, a small, maybe all volunteer nonprofit is much different in their needs of what we provide than larger, more well-established nonprofits. So it's really a diverse group, certainly makes the job interesting and different every day.
Mm-hmm. And, yes, I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, an interesting point that was always fascinating to me when you look at a metro area, and I call it metro because that's sort of a broadcast term of maybe 275, 280,000 people, probably a few more if you sneak into Ohio, into New York. With that, there are over 400 nonprofits that are in your membership. Are there more?
There are more. We do represent a large number of kind of what we call the functional nonprofits. So a nonprofit can be created. The only time that designation usually is taken away is when they don't file a tax return. So a 990, if they don't file that for 3 years, the IRS will revoke their exemption.
Yes.
So any organization that has that is functioning, that files 990s on a regular basis, a majority of them we represent. So we estimate that we represent probably about at least 80% of the nonprofits in Erie County.
It's still an astounding number of nonprofit organizations in such a small geographic area, relatively speaking, don't you think?
Yeah.
Sort of. We're laughing, folks, because we've talked about this several times. Now, with that said, that means there's a large number of people offering good service to different needs in the community, because your membership literally covers every type of nonprofit by category, I believe, that there is in the community, right?
Yeah. So it's there are a large number, but there are 1.5 million nonprofits in the United States.
Wow.
1.8 or 1.9 million if you add churches. So churches don't have to file 990s. So it's kind of hard to determine if how many churches there actually are, but they estimate about 1.9 million if churches are included in that figure. So and the nonprofit sector is one of the largest sectors outside of government. We're the third largest private sector. So behind retail and I'm blanking on the other.
Well, I think when you think about Erie, you think about manufacturing, I'm sure. That was...
Well, yeah. And nationally, the nonprofit sector has more employees than
manufacturing. Okay. So yeah, we have education, we have medical, the nonprofit sector. There's got to be a category we're missing in there right now.
The categories that they track are retail, food and beverage. And then retail, and then the nonprofit sector is the third largest.
Yes.
There's a study by Johns Hopkins. They estimate about 20% of the workforce in Erie County are in the nonprofit sector. So it's probably we're probably a larger representation than nationally. Nationally, it's about 12% of the workforce.
Oh, okay. That's the number I was shooting for. You're saying 28% then?
No, 20 in the Erie region.
In the Erie region, yeah.
And so, yeah, there are a number, but, you know, just, you know, some people ask often if there are too many nonprofits or if there are duplicative nonprofits, and my answer is, I don't know if there are too many. We tend to kind of still run in a free market system, and there's almost as many as can be supported. Are there duplication? Sure. There are duplicative services, but I think all of us want duplication that creates a level of competition that's necessary for efficiency and effectiveness. You know, we don't say, well, there should only be one bank, or there should only be one law firm, or there should only be one accountant. You know, we want to be able to pick and choose. And when you're talking about what the nonprofit sector does, you know, for example, if I have a child that has challenges with autism, I don't want to have to just go to one provider. I want to be able to choose from the providers that best fit the needs of my family. So,
and each provider does something a little bit different. I call it value added. Each one has its own. If I could interject one more thing relative to this topic, every nonprofit has its own board. And nonprofits are board driven. In other words, it could be the board of directors or the main person behind that nonprofit. This is their project, so to speak. This is their legacy, so to speak. Is that correct in this area here?
Yeah, the boards in the nonprofit sector, the board, for lack of a better term, are considered the moral owners of the nonprofit, and they boards were created and exist to basically represent the public good. So yes. Nonprofits are established to advance a public good. That's why we are tax exempt. So we serve some purpose that benefits the public. The board is the representative of the public. And again, they are legally and morally, but legally in many terms, the owners of the organization. We don't own things in the nonprofit sector, but nobody can fire the board. In extreme circumstances, I suppose the IRS could intervene or state government in some states, but
issue could come up. So it's not like a permanent position. Yeah.
No, but the board is the ultimate authority. So
yes.
And it doesn't lie with an executive director like myself. It lies with the board of directors. And in doing so, that creates a level of responsibility that boards have and should have over the protection and advancement of the mission of the organization. So they that is their kind of charge is to ensure that the mission is carried out to the best possible extent possible. And of course, they don't nor should they get involved in the weeds of managing the organization, unless it is an all-volunteer organization, but task that to professional staff that can carry that mission forward and their wishes forward.
The program is We Question and Learn. Today, our special guest, Adam Bratton, the executive director of the Nonprofit Partnership. You have a major affiliation. Is that the correct term? The Nonprofit Partnership resides on the same campus as the Erie Community Foundation.
Sure.
Could you describe that relationship for folks so they can get a better picture of how that works?
Yeah. So the as I mentioned, the partnership was originally conceived as a program of the foundation. Mm-hmm. It did become a separate nonprofit back in 2006 and 2007. Mm-hmm. We still have quite a bit of interaction with the foundation. We have foundation representation on our board of directors. We receive an annual grant every year from the foundation to continue our work. But more importantly, there is regular, probably daily interaction between the partnership and the foundation, really to advance the nonprofit sector. So the foundation exists as the primary funder of the sector in our region, an organization that galvanizes community support of the nonprofit sector, and the nonprofit partnership works alongside that by building the capacity of the sector. So they're two very complementary missions, and we work closely together to really support each other's missions, ultimately for the benefit of the nonprofit sector.
A recent guest on the program was Mike Batchelor, president of the Erie Community Foundation. Now, he mentioned a major event that occurs every year in conjunction, I believe, with the nonprofit partnership once a year.
Sure. Erie Gives?
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Erie Gives last year, I believe, was its 10th year. Blew the records out last year, raising over $6 million, and has been an incredible boon for the nonprofit sector in really helping all sorts of nonprofits, from the smallest to the biggest, raise additional fundraising revenue from the generous Erie community. So we have been a partner with them in promoting Erie Gives, providing resources and infrastructure to the nonprofits, helping them get the word out and making their case to their donors. So again, a great example of kind of the complementary relationship between us, where they drive the funding mechanism that is Erie Gives, and we drive the capacity or support of the nonprofit sector in pursuing funding for Erie Gives. So it's been an incredibly successful operation over the years, and this year was really remarkable considering the economic climate and the climate just in general, the fact that it I believe it raised over 800,000 more than it had in the previous year, which,
and you have to think about that, because I think Mike Batchelor and a lot of folks were worried that we'd experience a financial dip because of what's happening with COVID-19, and it went the other way, and thank goodness it did. Right.
No, it was incredibly demonstrative of the generosity of the community and the resiliency of the nonprofit sector, and certainly was needed. You know, the sector's gone through a lot, as has every sector in relation to COVID, and so those sorts of funds generated in our small community is. Certainly has a huge impact.
It's astounding. We have one of the largest, or at least one of the more prevalent community foundations, I believe, in the country. Can I go one step further and ask you, your organization, the Nonprofit Partnership, I don't want to say how do you rank relative to others, but are there other groups as this, or are we sort of unique? Is the Nonprofit Partnership a unique organization?
We are... as you said, sort of unique. So the organization like the Nonprofit Partnership really doesn't exist in many small cities like Erie. You'll find organizations like ours in Washington, D.C. or New York City or Chicago, large metropolitan areas that can sustain a nonprofit member-driven organization. So the fact that we exist in Erie is pretty unique. I haven't really found any complementary organization or similar organization that exists in a community our size. Again, it's usually statewide organizations that cover entire states or large cities. So it's certainly some credit goes to the Community Foundation for birthing this idea originally, and obviously for their ongoing support of the idea in providing nonprofits in the Erie community something that, again, really is unique for the size of Erie. And I get phone calls and connections pretty regularly from cities maybe similar to larger size cities about how we do what we do, and walking through with them ideas about how they can replicate what we do in their region. So it's it's certainly a somewhat unique offering to Erie.
You offer some incredible services. On the other hand, how large is your staff?
There are three of us. So myself and two other staff.
Yeah.
We do lean heavily on a very large network of consultants and speakers.
Yes.
And experts in the field that we've been able to develop relationships with. So we have a large network of national speakers and experts that provide content for us on a regular basis. And then certainly consultants locally, regionally, and nationally that also we can turn to or direct our nonprofits to if there's things that we cannot assist them with. But for the most part, a lot of that work is done within our walls, and we try to meet our nonprofits wherever they are, provide them with whatever they might need. And if we can't do it, then we try to find somebody who can.
Prior to the COVID scenario, you did a lot of live events at your new facility. I call it a new facility, if I may. But now in the 21st century here, you do a lot of online work?
Yeah, we regularly were providing in-person trainings, workshops, consultations, one-on-one or group work. So we were doing quite a bit of in-person, hands-on education training and consultations. Obviously, about second week of March, all that was shut down. Our facility has been closed since the second week of March, and we went 100% virtual. We were up and running with our virtual provisions rather quickly. So we...
You were geared up for this before because you were doing this kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. So it was in our plans to take some of our programming virtual and for a number of reasons. So we had the infrastructure already in place for virtual programming. So it was more just kind of turning on the switch and transitioning kind of our processes to go virtual. So within a couple of weeks, we were providing in the initial months of the COVID crisis, we were providing three sessions a week on a variety of topics. And initially, they were open to the public. Most of our programming traditionally is reserved for our membership, but like a lot of what was happening early on, we wanted to be able to do whatever we could for whoever might find value. So we opened up our training, our workshops, our educational programs, and saw a lot of folks coming from outside the region. So people who found out about the sessions. We were coming from all over the country. We had a lot of for-profit small businesses tapping into our sessions on the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP program.
Yes.
We had some really good programming around that. And so it was really an interesting time where we saw a totally different audience coming in for our programming. That's kind of settled down as we have kind of reverted back to providing our sessions for our membership, which is really our mission, is to support the nonprofit sector. And so things have calmed down a little bit, but it was interesting to see that initial response.
In the last couple of minutes here, now I saved the tough question for last, although Erie Gibbs Day, through the auspices of the your community foundation and the membership of the nonprofit partnership was exemplary. It was a sign of how generous Northwest Pennsylvania is. A more blunt question, how are the nonprofits faring right now?
Like I said, like any other sector, they are struggling. We are doing our best to help them find additional means of support. We really invested a lot of time and energy into the PPP funding that the federal government provided. We were able to help our nonprofits bring between $40 and $80 million into the sector through that initial offering.
Yes.
And you know, one thing that we have seen with nonprofits that have continued their fundraising efforts is that donors are really stepping up. So we've encouraged our nonprofits to continue to ask donors to support them, because donors have shown since March that they really want to support the nonprofit sector. So that has been a kind of a beacon of hope, but like any sector, they have struggled. They've had to, you know, a number of organizations have had to furlough employees or dismiss employees, have had to cut time. Certainly have had to do a number of difficult things, but you know, one thing that, you know, I don't think a lot of people realize is that, you know, the sector, at least the when we're talking about essential services, you know, we saw initially only essential organizations were allowed to stay open, and you know, all those providers with masks on and serving people. And a lot of those are nonprofits. So our nonprofits, a number of them didn't shut down. They were considered essential. A number of them serving people that could not go without services. And they made it work, and it was important that they did stay open. So it's been obviously a challenge. Hopefully we're on the back end of it. Hopefully, they can recover like we hope the entire economy recovers. But certainly not an easy time for those nonprofits, or the staff within.
Well, by the time this airs, we'll have been through the holiday. I will find you in spring, and hopefully you and I can update all the good information that you have and will have relative to the nonprofit sector in our community. I want to thank Adam Bratton, the executive director of the Nonprofit Partnership, for sharing his thoughts. And this was a really good education for me. As you know, I've been involved with you folks for a long time, but every time I listen to you, I learn something new. So may I say thank you very much for being part of the program today.
I appreciate the time, Tom. Look forward to seeing you in the new year.
I hope not virtually either. We'll see how that goes.
That'd be nice.
Okay, Adam Bratton, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin. These days, it seems like just about everybody is choosing sides and doubling down on talking points. Here at NPR, we try to cut through the noise with meaningful and respectful discussions with people from all perspectives, backgrounds, and walks of life. Join the conversation every weekend on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Saturday and Sunday afternoons at 5 on WQLN Radio.
Hi, this is Jeff Hanley, host of Jazz Happening Now. Each week we listen to some of the latest jazz recordings, and I think you'll be thrilled by what today's jazz musicians are doing and saying. The recording industry has changed, but the music is as alive and as vibrant as ever. The future of jazz is happening right now, if you just listen. And please do.
Sunday night at 6 on WQLN Radio.
Thank you. Welcome to Week Question and Learn. And today we have a very, very special guest, Dr. Andrew Roth, scholar in residence at the Jefferson Educational Society. Dr. Roth, I'm sure you've been busy up there, but let me congratulate you on your radio series.
Well, thank you, Tom. And thank you for your help in arranging that with WQLN. Yeah, the program is called the American Tapestry Project. It's on WQLN at, well, the same time as yours, second Sunday of every month at 4 p.m. And also, it's available on QLN's website into the indefinite future. It's also available on all of the major podcast sources, NPR One, Apple, Google, Spotify.
How long have you been doing this?
Well, I think we talked about this on a, earlier in another program some time ago. I got involved in this because I've been interested in American history all my life.
Yes.
But sometime around 2016, when I was serving as the interim president at St. Bonaventure University, Phil Payne, a member of the history department there, he and I got chatting about, is there such a thing as the American story? What is the American story? How would you tell the American story? And that, of course, in 2016, in hindsight, perhaps the 2016 presidential election was not nearly as fraught as the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election might be. But we began to think then that there was a major anniversary coming up, and that is that in 2018 would be the 50th anniversary of 1968. And we don't need to revisit all of 1968, but a lot of people think 1968 was the worst year in modern American history. And quite frankly, I think 2020 is threatening to give it a run for its money. Phil and I got talking about what is the American story. So I, in addition to all of the research I did and the presentations on 1968, I got interested in this idea, is there an American story? And I began to do research on it. And I tend to agree with the historian Jill Lepore that it's not really possible to tell the American story. The story is too complex. So I've come up with this metaphor that I call the American Tapestry Project. Mm-hmm. And the American Tapestry Project says that there may not be one American story, but there is a tapestry, a weaving together of many, many threads of many, many stories that collectively or when woven together are the story of America. And we've been exploring week or month after month on the radio program and on the podcast, those different threads.
And as you define, the threat. Now, you've categorized all these. I've heard you talk about it, but let's start from scratch.
With apologies, I always when I do it on the tapestry project, I always apologize to any real weaver who might be listening for oversimplifying their art. But in any weaving, there are two threads, two types of threads. There are the warp threads, and again, apologies to any weaver if I've gotten this kind of mishmashed. But if you can picture yourself sitting at a loom, the threads that are running perpendicular to you, in other words, they're running in straight lines towards you. Those are the warp threads that hold the weaving together. And then the threads that would run at right angles to you, left to, it works in both directions, right and left. Those are called the weft threads. And in a traditional weaving, such as a carpet or such as any fabric, you can see both the warp and the weft threads. But in a tapestry, the warp threads are hidden. All you can see are the surface, the weft threads, which tell the story that the tapestry tells or illustrates. And so, and that's enough on weaving, because I'm sure right now there's some weaver somewhere just wincing at how I've mangled that. But the metaphor then would be that in the American tapestry, I think there are at least four, five, six major warp threads that hold the whole thing together. And those major warp threads are, one, the American notion of freedom at home and abroad. We hold these truths to be self-evident. You know, the American creed, the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, probably one of the most famous paragraphs ever written in English. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's one of the major threads, the American creed. And I kind of simplify that to saying the great American ideals of liberty, freedom, equality, and opportunity. Not always honored, sometimes honored in the breach, but they are the fundamental, the foundational values. The second major warp thread, I have identified it, and there's, and on QLN's website, you would find a whole episode dedicated to freedom and liberty and what does it mean. And then there's a second episode on freedom's fault lines, which I call Freedom's Fault Lines, Tales of Race and Gender. And these are the American stories of about the people who were excluded from the initial definition of we, as in we hold these truths, as in we the people, the preamble to the Constitution. And who were those people? Well, to go back to the 18th century to keep it simple. They were everyone who was not a white male property owner. And I'm going to come back to that because one of the major threads is the ever-expanding definition of we. But for the moment, talking about freedom's fault lines, tales of race and gender, that is the story of the people who were originally excluded from those glittering ideals, those glittering statements, and their fight for inclusion by appealing to those ideals. So if you were to trace out the civil rights movement of the African Americans, if you were to trace out the, well, I guess we could call it the civil rights movement of the women's movement, and more recently, if you would trace out the indigenous people, Native Americans' attempts to have the 300 and I believe it's 87, don't hold me to that absolute number, but the 300 and some treaties the United States government signed with Native tribes from 1787 to the present, those people, they appeal for their inclusion by appealing to those very rights. As Martin Luther King said, just be true to what you said on paper. But the freedom's fault lines also, the people who would exclude them, who would deny them their inclusion, actually also do it by denying the American creed. And that works right down to the present. But perhaps most notoriously, I use it as an example, the most notoriously would be Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy's cornerstone speech, in which he explicitly stated that the Confederate government was founded on the exact opposite principles of the Declaration of Independence. That is, the Confederacy denied, rejected the Declaration of Independence, which is why, and I'm getting into the weeds here, so I'll back off a little bit, is which is why at Gettysburg, Lincoln invoked the Declaration of Independence and a rebirth of freedom. The third thread, which will be the subject of the December episode of the American Tapestry Project, is on the American dream, the notion, I don't know if Calvin Coolidge actually said it, the evidence suggests Cal didn't say it, but Calvin Coolidge's famous line that the business of America is business. And even if Cal didn't say it, he would have been right if he had said it. I'm not so sure if the business of America is only business, but it's a major part of who we are. The yes, I can do culture of entrepreneurialism, the culture of the rhetoric of rising, that you can become like that old army ad, all you can be. That is a big part of it. And then the fifth thread would be the immigrant's tale. That will be actually January's episode on QLN will be on the immigrant's tale, or at least the overview of it. And the immigrant's tale is everyone who is listening to this broadcast today is descended from an immigrant, unless you happen to be a person of Native American ancestry and you are descended from an indigenous person. Everyone else who is listening to this is descended from an immigrant. And as I point out, some earlier, some later, some willing, most willing, some unwilling, but regardless, you're descended from an immigrant. And the immigrant's tale is perhaps even the archetypal American tale of desperate people seeking opportunity, seeking liberty, freedom, equality, and opportunity, and willing to go to great lengths to take great chances to get that, if not for themselves, but then for their descendants, for their children and their children's children. And then lastly, there's what I call the fusion thread that kind of pulls all of this together. And the main theme of the fusion thread is the ever, and I touched on it a minute or two ago, the ever expanding definition of the we in our founding documents. I think that's the great triumph of American history, is that ever expanding we. And so if you were to ask me, what are the major themes of the American tapestry or of American history? I think it's really three things. It's one, the notion of liberty, freedom, equality, and opportunity. Trying to create a culture characterized by liberty, freedom, equality, and opportunity. I don't think, what's the old line? Who discovered water? It almost certainly wasn't a fish because you're in the midst of it. You can't see it. I know we have a lot of patriotic posturing and a lot of patriotic pride, but I don't think Americans understand just how rare, not only in the world of today, but in the history of the world, a society based on liberty, freedom, equality, and opportunity is. Let's just simply say it's not the default human position. It is a rarity. As imperfect as ours has been at times, it's still a rarity. And in the last 200 years, last 100 years more to the point, it's become a model that has been imitated, or at least attempted to be imitated, by a lot of societies. But that's all fairly, that's new and rare in the history of the world. So there's that. Then there's the second thing, would it be the ongoing experiment in self-government, which is also a comparatively rare thing in the history of the world. Democracy with a small d, republicanism with a small r. There have been other examples, other attempts at that in the history of the world. Most of those failed, quite frankly. The Roman Republic fell. A classical Athenian democracy in Athens lasted probably, well, we could quibble about that, but we'll say 150 years, 200 years. The British constitutional monarchy has got a couple of hundred years in running, but it's really not anything approaching what we call liberty, freedom, equality, and opportunity until the great reforms of the early and middle 19th century, when you really have a constitutional monarchy, and the monarchy has become more or less a figurehead. And so, you know, you've got those two things, liberty, freedom, and equality, self-government. And while we're trying to do those two things, which are extremely rare in human history, we're also trying to do something else that's very, not so much rare, but has had mixed results. And that is, we're trying to blend diverse people, people from all over the world, from all different kinds of cultures, into a people while respecting our diversity. That's what I mean by the ever-expanding definition of the we. So those three things, when you thread them together into a kind of, well, a helix usually has only two threads, so we'll say this is a tri, is that such a word? A tri-threaded helix. What we're trying to do in American history is not only very rare in the history of the world, it's very complicated in the history of the world. That's the American tapestry. That's the story of America. Now, whether you can say that's the story, I would say the story of America or the stories of America are the interwoven threads of all of those things. And that's why I think the tapestry metaphor is very appropriate, because that's literally what a tapestry is. It's a weaving that tells a story.
This is We Question and Learn, and I'm honored to have Dr. Andrew Roth discussing an outstanding project that now has made it to public radio. I'm not going to distract you from your itinerary there, but I did want to bring to light a couple of things. First of all, how did you come about the project? To me, you are, and forgive me for saying this, you're very emotionally and intellectually involved with the American tapestry. And I think folks have listened to you and have really been fascinated with the data and the information. I, for one, am massively impressed how you can recall all of this. So take that as a take that as a compliment. I tell people that you're a walking history book with photographic memory as an addendum. But personally, how did this come about in your career?
Well, that's a very good question, Tom. And I want to give you the so-called elevator answer to that.
That's okay.
I sometimes have the tendency, and I recognize it in myself. If you ask me what time it is, I'll tell you how to make a clock.
That's okay. That's all right.
rather than just saying it's whatever the time is as we're talking. I've always been interested in history and literature, and my undergraduate education is in that. But my career in higher education, for a variety of reasons that are of only of interest to me, and a handful of other people, rather than become the scholar that I was always working on becoming, I got involved in administration. And as you have pointed out, I think perhaps in the intro, maybe not, I ended up the president of two different institutions. So I can hardly apologize for my career. But my real love are books and learning and ideas and history and literature. And to a lesser extent, philosophy of ideas. Mm-hmm. And so a good friend of mine, I should probably actually mention him, a good friend of mine, Herm Weber, and I were discussing the vicissitudes of retirement. Mm-hmm. And Herm said, you need to reinvent yourself, because I kept getting calls asking me if I wanted to be the interim president of this, that, or the other thing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. I decided not so much to reinvent myself, but again, back to that 2016 conversation with Phil Payne at Bonaventure, mm-hmm. I decided what I was going to spend my retirement doing. And I'm not very good at retirement. Every time Ben Spagan introduces me on a Jefferson live stream, he points out I failed retirement. I decided in quote unquote retirement, I was going to do what I always loved to do. And well, some of these great scholars who I refer to and mention, every now and then I'm humbled by their work. I look at their bibliographies or their background, and from a careerist point of view, if one wanted to catch them, begging the question of whether or not I have the wit to catch them, if one wanted to catch them, you couldn't do it. I simply run out of time, literally. And that's life. Mm-hmm. And so what I've gotten involved here is I thought, well, what I can do, and this started at the Jefferson and then at the Siegel Institute of Lifelong Learning at Case Western Reserve, and then at the Chautauqua Institution, mm-hmm. and now on QLN, I thought, what I can do is I can take not just primary research, which I've been involved in, but I can also take the work of these other people and acknowledge it and put it together into a unified theory, if you will, and bring it to larger audiences than might read their, in some instances, highly specialized work. And in other instances, there are several of them that aim for what once upon a time used to be called the general reader. That actually is a phrase from public discourse describing the kind of person who read a lot but was not a scholar and made no pretense to be a scholar. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of working on behalf of those people in the electronic age is how I see it. So I've returned to, I'm not sure if this is really making sense as an answer to your question, but I got into it on a highly personal level because it was a return to my roots and doing what I love to do the most and going back to my academic and intellectual roots, if you will. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I just want to make this a neutral statement. As you present all this wonderful material over the huge number of hours, and we spent quite a few of those hours together, it was always fascinating to me how someone is able to accumulate, assimilate, and then interpret massive amounts of historical data and be able to recall it. I just wanted folks to understand that behind all this hard work and good presentation, there was a history and a person, and that maybe it's an inspiration to a younger scholar, so to speak, to really take an interest in what they do, and let me say this, and become a real expert at the topic.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'd call myself a real expert, but I think I'm reasonably well grounded in it, and I'm aware of my limitations, so I'm constantly attempting to learn. I do believe in the theory, on a personal note, that it's better to wear out than rust out. I really have no intention of stopping in doing this. A number of people have suggested to me that both the 1968 research and the American Tapestry could be turned into books. And
yes,
I think I will probably do that. The probably is a wee bit of a hedge, but you know, as long as I'm as energetic as I am now, I'm not going to give away my age, but I'm older than I
did. You sound.
I sometimes wonder how I got it. I mean, as I wake up in the morning, I think, good Lord, who's this old guy looking at me in the mirror? But
how did this happen? Yeah.
But all of us, how did this happen? But all of us, or many of us, have had that experience. And the younger people listening, they'll have that experience.
I wanted if I could interject for a half a second, I was fortunate enough to sit with Bob Chittister. And I don't think people understand that you have a touch of history with WQLN.
Yeah, I do. I've had a varied career, actually. And I once gave a talk to a group of the Ohio Foundation for Independent Colleges. And I said, sometimes if we were to really get into my background, you'd think you were talking to somebody with multiple personality disorder, at least multiple personalities. A long time ago, in the middle, late 70s, as a much younger, not very young, actually, in those days, I would have been in my late 20s, early 30s. So it's not all that young. Seems young to me today.
Yes.
But I was a young faculty member at Mercyhurst then college, and we had a satellite studio at Mercyhurst of WQLN in the early days.
Yes.
And what I did was I was a member of the QLN board, and I'm not so sure that it was a one-to-one representation of Mercyhurst, because I think I actually was nominated. The late Betty Gartner, I believe, nominated me, and I ended up on the board. So I met Bob and got to watch and be a front row observer in many ways to the terrific job he did back then, actually creating WQLN.
Yes.
And so that was interesting. And then, of course, I also did radio. I did a program back in those days called Andy Roth's Sight and Sound, which aired on Saturday night. And it was a combination of book and film reviews and jazz and music selections. And quite frankly, they say, you know, flattery is the sincerest form of imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And there was a program on WCLV in Cleveland with a yes. fellow by the name of Tom Conrad,
yes.
Who did a program on Saturday night. And I somewhat basically mimicked his format and kind of fast forwarding the tape some 30 years into the future. I got to know Tom Conrad. I met him at WCLV when I would be interviewed for doing things when I served as president of Notre Dame College. And I told him what I had done. And he said, he said, wonderful. He said he took it as a compliment.
Wonderful.
But I'd been involved with QLN for years. And then, again, showing the different facets of all of the things I've done, there was a program. I was the original host of the television high school quiz show in Erie, High Q, sponsored by the Manufacturers Association.
Oh,
and that was also in the late 70s. I don't think we did it into the 80s, or I didn't. It continued, A.J. Micelli and some others.
Yes.
But in any event, when we did that program, the late Chet Giermack was the in effect, the producer. He's the CEO of Eries Magnetics.
Yes.
And Eries Magnetics was the sponsor, the patron, I believe we use at QLN in public media, benefactor. And we recorded that program, even though it aired on WICU, we recorded it in WQLN's television studios.
Yes.
And so I've been involved with WQLN for a long time. Then, of course, there was a big gap when I wasn't involved because I wasn't in Erie. But there's a bit of a history. But it was really fascinating to watch Bob and his entrepreneurial zeal as he created WQLN. And I think the people of Erie owe him, and other people like Lou Pollock and other civic-minded individuals, you know, a debt of gratitude. They created that, and I think it's incumbent on people today to keep it going.
Well, forgive me for taking the last...
It's a valuable community asset.
Oh, thank you. That's a generous statement. And forgive me for taking the last third of our time here to talk about you. I think people need to, you know, gain a perspective of the person delivering all this wonderful information. And if I could take a half a second to thank you, because I'm not sure people really understand what goes into assembling a program as you have. We've done four or five together. You've done six already on your own. I just want people to appreciate the energy that it takes to assemble this. If that's a good word.
And I've done a number of live streams. One of the things, here's the power of media.
Yeah.
When I would do a presentation, when I did the workshops at Chautauqua, there would actually be, even at Chautauqua, there would be, in the Hall of Philosophy, not the big amphitheater, but the Hall of Philosophy.
Yes.
That holds about 500-600 people. So those were substantive crowds. But when you do the Rhodes Scholars, those were audiences of 50 or 60.
Yes.
When you do the presentations in Cleveland and elsewhere, and one of the things you discover with, the discovery of the obvious, the power of media is that just by some order of magnitude, you've increased the size of the audience. And I've done a number, I don't even know how many presentations I've done at the Jefferson, because nowadays, I only represent myself as a scholar in residence at the Jefferson Educational Society, which is another really valuable community asset.
Yes.
That I'm not entirely sure all Erieites anyways. I know there's a cadre of Jeffersonians who get it. How valuable that is as a community resource, and how rare that a community the size of Erie actually has something like the Jefferson Educational Society. It's a model for the future, and I don't know. I have no idea what Furkey and the people there, Furkey Ferrati, the president of it, and his board, but it's a terrific thing. And I've given and Charles Brock deserves a debt of gratitude for helping launch that.
Yes.
I've done, I couldn't tell you, 20 or 30 presentations there. And you do it with audiences that range on the low side from 30 or 40 on a cold night in February to on the high side, 90 to 100. And we've been doing things on live stream on Facebook and on the web and on our own YouTube channel. And it's just amazing. Suddenly you double, triple, quadruple.
Dr. Roth, this is the worst part of my job. You know what I'm going to have to tell you.
Yeah, time's up.
Time's
it's okay.
And I know that you're getting very familiar with that because I'm sure the producers have waved at you. Or if you're recording on your own, you're probably looking in the mirror and going, I need to stop because the clock has run out. But
I'm very conscious of
that.
Learning that.
That's okay. And this automatically on our program gives you an invitation to come back. I hope you'll accept that one. I send you that email.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for all your good work. But best of all, thank you for all the things that I've learned from you.